Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and we're so glad that you took the time to download us and that you're joining us this week for another interesting person in the world of sports medicine and human performance. We are pleased to have with us Dr. Emily Schmidt today. Emily, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I'm going to tell the audience a little bit about you.
Okay.
And then we'll just get into the conversation. As I said, we're pleased to have Emily with us. I've known Emily for a long time. Emily got her undergraduate degree from Elon University. All those of you at Elon right now that are listening, you can cheer. She got a master's degree in clinical exercise physiology at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. She finished a PhD in exercise science here at Texas A&M. She is currently now a federally funded research postdoctoral fellowship in the lab of Dr. Weston Porter, and we're going to talk about her work in that lab today. Actually, we're going to talk about some of her work a little bit before that, but that led to the work that she's doing now. We can say that she's certainly working in the field of environmental toxicology. And so, again, welcome to the podcast today, Emily.
Thanks. I'm excited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's just get started off really easy.
Okay.
Somebody listening to the intro may have picked up that you were doing exercise science stuff, and now you're doing toxicology, environmental toxicology. That seems to be a leap. Tell us how you got there. How did you get from exercise science to environmental toxicology?
Well, it was quite a jump, but I had this really awesome boss who had this idea that maybe environmental toxicants, things we're exposed to every day, could actually affect sex hormones. And if you're familiar, sex hormones can actually influence physical activity. Hmm. So we had this idea that maybe some of the things that we were exposed to on a daily basis was actually affecting our sex hormones, which in turn were decreasing physical activity levels in the human population sort of all over the world.
And that seems a little bit of a stretch, but it's no doubt physical activity levels are going down across
right.
the world.
And there haven't been a whole lot of, I don't know, I guess components that have sort of figured that out.
Yeah.
So any information that we can sort of add to that story is going to be new information and hopefully reliable information that we can sort of kind of put those puzzle pieces together to figure out why we are so inactive as a population.
Now, somebody out there in the audience may say, well, I'm inactive because I just don't want to be active. And it's all about up between my ears. So why do we have to worry about things like environmental toxicants if it's just my motivation?
Well, it's not so much motivation as some of these things are formed, these characteristics are formed in utero. So some of these things you might not have any control of even after you're born. So that's sort of the experiment that I did was looking at a common phthalate. I exposed mothers to this phthalate in utero, and we saw that it actually affected physical activity levels of the offspring of the mice that weren't directly affected, but just affected in utero.
So tell us about phthalates. That doesn't sound like they're very common. I don't hear about them in my normal daily life.
Phthalates are very common. It's not quite as common as BAP, which most of the audience might be familiar with. BPA, free bottles and things like that. But phthalates, in particular, the one that I looked at was benzyl butyl phthalate, and it's everywhere. It's in plastic. It's in vinyl. It's in shower curtains, carpet, nail polish, shampoo. It's in healthcare products that you use every day. Where you're not necessarily knowing that you're being unhealthy by using these products, but we actually are from all of the exposure that we have just to daily cleaning supplies and chemicals that we use.
Now, so that point, though, is quite important because you looked at the effect on pregnant mothers
right.
of exposure to this BBP
right.
And the effect on their offspring. Why is that a concern for pregnant women? How does that translate into humans?
So the endocrine system is formed mostly in utero, and you can have a lot of, I guess, things go wrong in utero specifically to the endocrine system. So mothers need to be highly aware of what they put into their bodies, what they surround themselves with, and sort of how they carry out themselves through pregnancy, not just, you know, diet and exercise and getting sleep and all of that, but also being aware of lotion that you put on, certain deodorant, certain shampoo, things that you don't think are actually harming your unborn child, but could actually cause some pretty detrimental consequences.
Yeah, even some makeups, right? Some
facial care products.
Oh,
just face wash. I mean, it's honestly terrifying to think about all the products out there. And, you know, one product might not be that bad, but whenever you sort of think about, you know, a woman who has their usual beauty routine, I mean, there's quite a bit of products that most women use on a daily basis, and you don't necessarily know that it's actually, you know, it can leach through your skin. You can, you know, swallow some of these contaminants. It's in food. So there's really kind of a wide array of products that can harm the fetus.
Now, was this change that you saw in activity? You were looking at whether or not the offspring were very active.
Right.
Was that a big change?
No, it was a big change. I think we had at least a 60% decrease, with the males, and maybe not quite so much, but still over 50% for the females. So we did have a decrease with the males and the females in their reduction in activity. Throughout, we looked up to 20 weeks. So it's not like we just did this study for 5 days. I mean, this was a months long, sort of not longitudinal, but long enough to sort of get a grasp on this data, and that these mice were actually affected just in terms of their voluntary wheel running. So they were not exercising as much as the mice that weren't exposed to this phthalate in utero.
So a 20-week-old mice is about, what's that equivalent in humans?
It's about 40 years old. So you're talking, you know, midlife.
So you were taking these mice from birth until midlife, monitoring their activity, and you saw they had that big a decrease in activity just because they were exposed in utero.
Right. Well, they were actually decreased in activity every single week from the control mice. And then as time went on, that got statistically bigger.
Yeah. So that got you obviously interested in the effects of the environment.
Yeah.
Environment toxicants on activity.
Yeah.
And so you moved on to a postdoc.
I did
a postdoc now. And so share a little bit about with us how you expanded what you're doing now in your postdoc.
Well, I obviously wanted to learn a little bit more of the toxicology world so I could eventually bring that back to the exercise physiology world when I really get into a faculty position. But I am looking at circadian rhythms, actually, and some of the consequences that disrupting circadian rhythms can have on cancer progression and mammary gland development specifically. So I do work in a mammary gland development biology laboratory in the toxicology department. So I'm sort of kind of figuring out my own way to bring that back to the exercise world.
So tell us about circadian rhythms. You mentioned that. All of our audience may not be aware of what those are.
Yeah, I really wasn't too aware either, and I didn't know I cared until I started studying this. but they're actually really cool, and there was a big study that came out in the 90s. It was called the Nurses' Health Study, and what they did was they kind of retrospectively looked at breast cancer incidences in women, and they found that women that worked the night shift for a couple decades, about 3 decades, so about 30 years, they actually had increased incidence of breast cancer risk. So a lot of research the past few years has focused on this sort of night shift work and working at night and being awake during the night and sleeping during the day can really have a profound impact on your health, even if you get 8 hours of sleep. It sort of matters at what time of the day you're getting that 8 hours of sleep. So that's sort of what I've been looking at lately.
So now we have to worry not only about getting enough sleep, but getting it at the right time.
Right, exactly. So
why does the right time matter?
Well,
are things changing in the body? And
yes, yeah. Things are definitely changing. So one of the studies that we are looking at right now is benzoapyrene. It's a combustion product of cigarette smoke and just barbecue. So it's a common compound. Like BBP, that we are exposed to. And we're actually finding that in human breast cancer cell lines and in a mouse model, that when you're exposed to that compound at midnight, it's actually worse and your body is not able to metabolize it as correctly as when you're exposed to that compound at noon. So at noon, your body is able to sort of kind of get back to homeostasis and sort of work itself out, I guess, if you will. But when you're exposed at midnight, and you're constantly exposed to these things at midnight throughout, you know, long periods of time, it can actually have some pretty harmful effects.
So eat barbecue at noon and not at
yes,
midnight.
Don't have your barbecues at midnight. Try to have them. Try not to really have them at all, but definitely at noon, more so than midnight.
So what's the application of your work? I mean, is this something that we're going to start seeing warning labels that say, don't do night shift work or you may increase your chance of breast cancer? Or?
Well, I mean, I certainly don't want to say don't do night shift work because there are people that can only do shift work and that want to work the night shift and that works for their schedule. And, you know, that's what they want to do. And we certainly need these people in the hospital at 3 a.m. Doing this work for us. So I think it's more so having people be aware that this could potentially be a health concern. Certainly, you know, not someone that is in grad school and is up for 5 years and are on weird schedules, you know, your body sort of works itself out. But if a young person is wanting at, you know, 23 years of age to have this long nursing career, maybe say, hey, work the night shift, but only for a few years and really sort of maybe focus on, you know, trying to find different time of day to do that. But I also want to bring exercise back into that and sort of maybe think of some therapeutic ways that we can use exercise to help mitigate some of these harmful effects. So
you just brought up an interesting point, and that is the research may not be there. You said the people in the nurses health study were there 30 years.
Right.
Is there a magic threshold that you don't have problems? Is it 10 years, 20 years?
That's a good question. I honestly don't know. I know that the longer that you are on shift work throughout your life, the worse that, you know, your chances of developing a cancer can occur. And this is the same thing for flight attendants and, you know, just night shift working.
Do you have any data that exercise, because you're talking about using exercise to mediate some of this stuff, do you have any evidence that exercise may offset some of these changes?
Definitely. What I wanted to say was, especially with the exercise science world, and if you just do a quick Google Scholar search or a PubMed search and you type in exercise and time of day or something, most things in the exercise world are looking at optimal performance. So at what time of day are your muscles the strongest to, you know, bench press however much weight, or what time of day should you do cardio to optimize health benefits. And while that's definitely important and that research is needed, I sort of want to take it a little bit different and see if exercising, say, before a night shift can actually mitigate some of these harmful exposures of these environmental chemicals that we are exposed to that can actually decrease the half-life and the time that these chemicals spend in your body. I'm not quite sure when that timing is going to be or how that's going to work out, but that's sort of my hope and what I'm trying to focus on, to sort of merge this toxicology and exercise physiology world together.
So do you have some data right now that maybe indicates that
yes,
animals that are active have less of some of this problematic?
Yes. So I did do a quick study that I was actually really excited to get into. I took liver samples and I took mammary gland samples from I guess they were just females, that were on a running wheel. And then I had samples from females that were just control animals that were just in a cage. So they didn't have running wheels. So the main thing from that is that, these two groups of mice were not exposed to anything. They were both technically control mice. One group just had a running wheel, and the mice that had access to a running wheel, had different, levels of CYP activity compared to, and CYP is one of the drug metabolism genes that sort of metabolizes out some of these harmful chemicals. And so we saw varying levels between the mammary gland and the liver just in both of these two different sample sets where you wouldn't necessarily think that they would be different, but they actually are just from the mice running, just from being active compared to the mice that weren't.
And so that would indicate, that would give you hope that exercise is providing a positive offset for some of these changes.
No, it got us really excited because, you know, we want to look at the brain. We want to look at the liver. There's peripheral clocks in the kidney. I mean, mammary gland is sort of what I'm studying right now, but this sort of opens up a whole new world to being able to study time of day of exercise with windows of exposure to these certain compounds.
Yeah. So Emily, all this stuff is really interesting. So tell me where you think you're going to be in 5 years, not as far as career-wise, but research-wise. I mean, where do you see this going? This research going?
I think that within a few years, with just a few studies, we might be able to actually pinpoint time of day that people that work shift work should be exercising, and maybe sort of give guidelines. Especially, we have the whole issue of, do people want to exercise? No. But the people that do want to exercise, hopefully we can maybe give them a better time of day and just sort of some guidelines health-wise of when they can exercise, because their internal clock is already messed up and it's going to be weird times of day anyway. But if we actually have some good evidence and some concrete studies that we can base off of when to give certain time guidelines of when to exercise, that would sort of be the goal. If you're going to run for 30 minutes, especially for people that are doing shift work, that when you run for that 30 minutes a day, what time you do that could maybe potentially play a huge role in mitigating some of these harmful effects. So if you are a nurse or a young woman or somebody that wants to be a flight attendant and work for 30 years, maybe that's fine as long as you exercise at 2 a.m. I don't know when that's going to be. But my hope is to sort of gain a better understanding if exercising at certain times can sort of mitigate some of these harmful exposure times.
Well, and if nothing else, if they're active for 30 minutes, then you're mitigating some cardiovascular disease.
Oh, yeah.
They're doing the things they're supposed to do anyway.
Well, yeah.
All those other fun things.
Right.
Yeah. Regular listeners of the podcast always know that we ask our guests how they came to be where they're at. Is this something like when you were 5 years old, you said, wow, this is really cool. I'm really interested in the environment and exercise.
Yeah, no, definitely not.
How did you get here?
I was always interested in science. I always loved, the science museum, and I was always outside sort of exploring. But when I got to college, I did elementary education. I thought that, I wanted to teach and I wanted to do that. And I got into a classroom and I said, this is not for me, especially elementary education. And, bless the people that can do that. But that just was not for me. And, I started looking through the book at Elon, and, I had conversations with my parents and they said, you should do exercise sports science. Why are you not doing exercise sports science?
Because you were on the track team.
I was on the track team.
Right.
I mean, it sort of was a no brainer, but to be honest, I was just, I sort of knew my weaknesses and my limitations at that time. And I honestly didn't think I could handle those science classes. And looking back, I did very well, and I'm appreciative of, all of the mentors and professors that sort of kept me on track. But it was just sort of a whole accumulation of events that just sort of led me to the exercise science world. And I'm so happy that that's what I ended up doing, because I am. This has been a great decade. And, I did my master's in clinical exercise physiology, and then I worked in cancer rehab and I loved it. But there was one defining moment actually where we had a tumor board, sort of thing that we did in the cancer center, where every Friday morning they presented rare studies, and I was invited to go, and I just sat in the back. I couldn't participate, but I could listen. I thought this was the coolest thing. And up at the front, they had histologists and MDs and PhDs and people that were actually having this conversation about how to treat this, what should we do? And it was just sort of one of those, I did not know that that's what I wanted to do until that particular moment. And then everything just sort of fell into place, with that. And so here I am.
And here you are.
Exactly.
Here you are. Well, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
It's been great, and we wish you the best of luck in
the
future studies.
Thank you very much.
So, and we also want to thank all of you that have been listening for taking the time to be with us. As our listening audience knows, we always give our guests an opportunity to give us a take-home message of the week. So if there's one thing that you want the audience to remember from this podcast, what would that be?
The take-home message is that you never know where there are going to be opportunities in science to sort of merge your passions together. I never knew that working in the toxicology field would be applicable to the exercise physiology world, but it's working out really well. And I guess the take-home message would be to just always sort of look for science in unexpected places and ways that you can sort of come up with your own ideas and advance the field.
Excellent take-home message. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's been great to have you here.
I'm happy to be back.
Yeah. And so I want to thank all of you for taking the time to download us and listen. Regular listeners know that this is the time when we ask the podcast question of the week. And so here with the podcast question of the week is our executive producer, Kenneth McIntyre.
What chemical was responsible for the reduction in activity among mice in Dr. Schmidt's study?
Great podcast question, Kenneth. Be the first person to send us the correct answer via email to huffines@tamu, and that's TAMU.edu, and you will win one of our nifty podcast t-shirts. Again, send that email to huffines@tamu.edu, and don't think you're too late. We sometimes give multiple t-shirts in a week. And Emily, thank you again for being here with us
this week.
And for all of you listening, we hope that you have a happy holiday season. We're going to take a bit of an intermission in the podcast production, and so we will be back with you in the middle of January 2017. And so until then, we hope that you are active and healthy.
The executive producer of the Sports Medicine Podcast is Kenneth McIntyre. This podcast is licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffines@tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.